Dear listener, if you like this podcast, I want to tell you about something else you might enjoy as well. Every week, I host an online meetup. In each meeting, I give a presentation on some programming topic, or I bring a guest to the group for a discussion, or I do a code review on a member's code base, or I do some kind of consultation with one of our members. Coming to this meetup is kind of like listening to this podcast, except it's live and interactive, which means you get a chance to ask questions and participate in a conversation with other programmers like yourself. The meetup is also a fun place to meet some new friends. To learn more and to sign up, visit codewithjason.com/meetup. Now on to the episode. Hey, today I'm here with Alex Bunardzik. Alex, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Jason. I'm really excited to be on your show. Looking forward to continuing our chat that we started yesterday. I'm pretty sure the topics will be exciting, and we are going to continue exploring various topics in our profession. So what did you have in mind to talk about today?
Yeah, well, I really enjoyed our conversation yesterday, which was our first time meeting. And we talked about TDD and consulting and various other topics. Maybe we can start by talking about testing. The first thing I maybe would like to ask you about testing is, why is it something you're interested in? Why bother doing testing at all?
Well, that's a really good question, and I must say I wasn't like this always. I started my career without having any idea about testing, other than manual testing you give to so-called testers or quality assurance. But us developers or coders or programmers, we were just supposed to write code and give it to someone else to test. And then I joined the team that are really hot on extreme programming. It was back in 2001, I believe. And one of the big topics was test-driven development. And they were like really fawning over Ken Beck's entire approach to software. And frankly, to me, it sounded really didn't make any sense. I just couldn't, two things that I was couldn't grok. One is, why would I waste time writing yet more code than I'm actually writing? Because back then, times were different, and we were being measured by the lines of code or something like that, some metric that's like just meaningless today. And so why would I waste time writing tests when actually I'm paid to deliver production code, shipping code? That didn't make any sense to me. And furthermore, I was really stumped. I'm saying, okay, look, if we are saying that we are not qualified enough to write quality code, and therefore we need to write tests, what makes us think that all of a sudden we'll be good at writing tests? Like, if you suck at writing code, then we will suck at writing tests. So it's like, what's the point? On the other hand, if we don't suck at writing code, then writing tests would be a waste of time. So that was my kind of completely delusional way of viewing this thing. And today I meet a number of people who kind of still think like that. And they always push back, and for the exact same reasons. Like, look, man, if you don't trust me on being able to write good code, how come you trust me to write good tests? Isn't it the same issue? And furthermore, why do you want me to slow down and waste time writing tests when we're not gonna ship tests to the paying customers? Therefore, I cannot charge for the time I'm writing tests, right? So that was the two big hurdles that I had to overcome. And the way I did manage to finally see the light is by realizing that I'm not such a good coder to begin with. I suck. And then I realized that I cannot heroically just expect to sit down and bam, here's a perfectly crafted code, and then I move on to writing another routine or another module. And then it dawned on me that there is a lot of iteration. In other words, the way we were taught at school when we are writing an essay, that you cannot just sit down and bang an essay and submit it. You have to have first draft and circle back to second draft review. And this is the proper way of creating content, that we have to go back and iteratively increase the resolution. Because the first pass, we're just throwing mud against the wall, throwing some thoughts on paper. It's kind of half-baked. There's a lot of syntactical and semantic errors and grammar and even spelling errors. And then we keep circling back and improving, polishing, increasing the resolution until we get to the point where we're saying, okay, well, I can ship that. And so exact same approach applies to writing code. Now, interestingly, I know a lot of people, even to this day, who totally are not buying into that. They think that if you are good at what you're doing, you ought to be able to deliver on the first attempt. If you can't, then you suck at it and you shouldn't be doing it. So that's another kind of hurdle that I often find in teams. And I find that people with that opinion are very, very difficult to convince to start writing tests. So that aside, another thing I realized is that we are actually using to build systems that are delivering functionality, we're using code as text. And machines do not understand text. And so if I go and I write some text, code as text, or modify, at that point, especially in the early days when we did not have sophisticated IDEs and editors, I could write anything and the editor is not going to complain. It's not going to push back, right? So for me to actually verify that what I wrote actually works as I expected, I need to jump through some hoops until eventually I see the result of my change. And usually I go in, I make a change, and then I have to manually, I save it. I have to manually try and compile. I have to manually build, configure. Then I have to manually start the app. Then I go and navigate to the part of the app where I think the change is actually going to manifest. Of course, before that, I need to manually log in with certain credentials. Then I go to the app, to the part of the app where the change has been made. Then I enter manually, type in some test data, and I submit, and I see if it actually delivers or behaves as I expected. That is a very convoluted and very involved process, which means that the feedback of my change is quite long. It's quite, there's a latency is quite substantial.
And I'd also add costly.
Costly. And also, it's a lot of manual chores, a lot of heavy lifting, error prone, tedious.
Yeah. That's what I mean by the cost part. It costs you all this effort and annoyance and all that stuff.
Yeah. And then even if I verified, oh yes, it behaves the way I expected, then I have to log out and log in with different credentials that will give it a different context and repeat that. And so I'm actually burning hours there, right? Not writing any code, not contributing, not being productive. And we are good at automating other people's tasks. Why don't we focus on automating our own chores? Like nobody thinks about that. It's like cobbler's children's shoes, right?
Right.
He's putting shoes, but his own children don't have shoes. So it dawned on me that, look, we should actually automate our own process and we should eliminate those manual pedestrian tasks. And why don't we have we are engineers. We should engineer the system that will do it all on our behalf, right? It suddenly dawned on me that TDD is actually doing exactly that. TDD is actually automating what I'm doing manually. Right, it's gonna, anytime I make a change, I run the tests, and the tests are gonna do everything that I was doing manually. And in that way, I am buying myself a much smaller latency, much shorter wait time from the moment I make a change until the moment I verify, does it work as expected, or it has something broke, did something break down? And that establishes a nice flow, a nice little flow of almost like stream of consciousness, where you are constantly revisiting and refactoring and making your code better and better while incrementally improving its functionality. And this is something that Kent Beck calls permaculture by succession.
I don't know permaculture by succession.
Exactly. So he has a really nice illustration. He says, imagine somebody hires you to implement a forest in a barren terrain. Let's say there is a really barren terrain, nothing, just barren after clear cut or something, nothing there. Now they ask you, okay, we want you to build a forest there. Well, if you go and you start like really heroically trying to plant trees and bring, you know, it's going to be touch and go. But instead, you should start with like really in a few successions. The first iteration should be some really resilient shrubs or grass that can just kind of thrive in those harsh conditions. But it will help build a little bit of soil, keep it from the wind blowing the soil. Then the next iteration, you bring some shrubs like manzanita shrubs and all these like plants that can thrive in not so optimal conditions. And then succession after succession, eventually you create conditions where you can go in and plant Douglas fir trees and they will flourish. So what's significant about that is that you know, you're aware of that your first design is just going to be very flimsy. It's not where you really want to be, but you know that you have to, step by step, by succession, get there. You cannot get there in one, you know, giant leap. And same, I mean, his teaching does the same as with software. We start with something really basic, really, you know, bare bones, and then establish that and build on top of that and on top of that. We iterate.
Okay.
We increase the resume.
Let's maybe talk about this concretely. Because I think I understand what you mean, but I'm not sure that everybody listening is going to know what you mean. I'll share an example program. I'm in the process of rewriting my Rails testing book. And the first chapter is, the title of it is Tests as Specifications. And, you know, in TDD, I think a lot of people, including myself early on, think it's kind of funny that we write a test, a failing test first, and then we write the code to make it pass. It feels unnatural. But I think when you phrase it in the, when you think about it in the sense that you're thinking of the specification first and you're articulating the specification and then you write the code to meet the specification, that makes a lot more sense. You're deciding what to do and then you do it. That sequence makes sense. And so that's my first chapter, and I wanted to give somebody an example that they could go by to come up with some specifications for. And I did this same example when I put on a TDD workshop at RailsConf last month. The example is a recipe scaler. So I actually have this chapter in my book in front of me. Let's say a recipe calls for 1/3 of a cup of flour, and you want to scale this recipe instead of, you know, this recipe, maybe it yields 6 servings, but you want to serve 12 people. So you scale the recipe by 2, you multiply 1/3 cup flour by 2, and you get 2/3 cups of flour. And that is a very straightforward case, but if you think about this program more deeply, there's all sorts of edge cases. Like, what if you multiply 1/3 cup flour by 3, then you get 3/3 cup flour? It's like, well, that's not right. It should be 1 cup flour. Or if you multiply it by 6 and you get 6/3 cup flour, or let's say you multiply it by 4, you get 4/3 cup flour. That's not right. It should be a mixed number. It should be 1 1/3. And there's all, if you think about it more and more deeply, there's all these different cases that you could encounter. And all these things are specifications. You have to specify under such and such scenario, this happens. Under such and such other scenario, this other thing happens. And Alex, I actually forget the question I was going to ask you based on that. Oh yeah, we were talking about the permaculture by succession. So if we take this example of this recipe Scalar, do you have an idea of how you might apply that permaculture by succession idea?
Yes, usually we can do it in formulaic way, or we can do it more ad lib. But let me explain about the formulaic way I like to use. So this is something I learned from James Granning. I don't know if you've heard of James Granning.
No.
He's the co-signatory of the Agile Manifesto. I really like super duper guru coder. He specializes in embedded systems. He's building like hardcore, you know, software. Amazing guy. And I always enjoy interacting with him. Anyway, he invented this formula, which I find very handy. It's called zombies. I don't know if you heard of zombies.
I have.
Yeah. It's basically acronym. And Z or Z for Americans stands for zero, or something's not there. O in zombies stands for one. M stands for many. B stands for boundaries. I stands for interfaces. E stands for escaping, sorry. And then S for simplicity. So I always start with zero. As I'm doing this kind of a gradual or succession, starting from the simplest, bare bones, nothing there, I write my specification. I like to call them expectations. I expect certain things from the system. So I'm asking, what would the system do if it's nothing there? What do I get? The system, maybe you need to accomplish something, but bam, nothing's there. So it has to be able to not crash, but give you some kind of indication that, all right, we don't have anything there, nothing to work with. So first I'm writing an expectation to say, what if it's nothing there? What if there's no, whatever it is, there is no such module, or there is no any volume or any of that cup of flour or something, not there. So the system will then, you'd specify expectations there. What do you expect the system to tell you then, right? Once you start that out, and of course, your expectation will fail, right? First you say, I'm expecting this, and then you run the test and it will fail and it will tell you exactly why it failed. Then you make it pass, right?
Okay, sorry, I have to interrupt you there.
No problem.
When I did this workshop, there was a stumbling block that some people encountered, and this is by no means unique to this particular example. The scenario that I laid out for people is Rails is complicated. Full stack web applications are complicated. When you write tests for them, there's a whole lot of baggage and stuff. So let's forget about all that. Let's write a program that's just pure Ruby on the command line. What you'll get is you'll get a plain text file containing not even an entire recipe, just a list of ingredients, one ingredient per line. And what you have to do is write a program where you can say, like on the command line, rubyscaler.rb, and then give it the file name as an argument, and then give it the amount you want to scale it by as the second argument. And so, if somebody has absolutely no idea how to begin writing tests for this, you can say, you know, okay, the first scenario is that the ingredient is blank or whatever. The person might not know what the appropriate entry point is to writing that test. So how would you suggest they start that process?
Again, I would think in terms of zero, which means either the file is not there, or if the file is there, it's empty. There's no content. And then I would write a little expectation or a test that will assert that the content is blank or zero, or however you want to assert that, and will then expect that the system will alert the whoever is the client of the system, whoever is using it, that, hey, we cannot proceed here because here's a dead stop. We have nothing to work with. Therefore,
yeah,
you know, either supply something or but I don't know. I at this point, I'm stuck. I don't know what to do. So that's your zero scenario, right?
Okay. So I'm with you so far. I agree with all that. Let me get even more precise. And I'm curious. I'll share my way of approaching that, and I'm curious if your way would be similar or different. I might encourage people to leave out dependencies. So if you have to interact with the file system, that is arguably a dependency. And you could write a test which reads in a sample file. You have a fixture on the file system and it reads that in and it's blank. That's totally valid and fine and everything. Or you could decide that the part of the program you're testing is just the part that happens after that. So you have an object which takes the file content as an argument. Or you could take it even further. You have an object that takes one single ingredient as an argument. And then on the other side, the UI is kind of a dependency. Like, there's all these decisions to be made about how is the output shown to the user and stuff like that. And like, I think maybe that's too much to think about in the beginning. So it's like, okay, forget about that. Let's just say this object takes one item as an input, and then as output, it just gives back a string. And that way you limit the stuff you have to think about. Would you think about that approach in a similar way, or would you think about it in a different way?
I would think in exactly that way. And I'm sorry, I forgot to clarify one thing. I'm really big on this, and this is very controversial, but I very, very much insist on doing TDD by avoiding I/O operations. That is like the prime directive. And people are like, oh, that's stupid. But I realize that if we are doing our best to avoid dependencies, like you say, and most of these, I would say almost all of these dependencies are I/O bound, meaning they are reaching across. So let's think about only what happens in the main memory. There's a code that's running in the main memory, and a test is the first client of that code, of that nascent code that is about to be. The first thing we do is we declare executable expectation. I'm expecting that when I interact with this system that is yet to be, or maybe it's there, but it's just like a walking skeleton, just bare bones, nothing there. But it's in main memory. It's not somewhere out there on the network or the file system or the database. I'm expecting, first thing, that I get nothing from that system. I'm expecting some values, but I got like blank string or empty array or empty collection or something that's just nothing for me to work with. And I totally agree with you. It's much better if we are not reaching out to the I/O and saying, oh, the file is not there. But have a system that is capable of ingesting somehow. And this is where the hexagonal architecture comes into play, which is, I'm a big fan of ports and adapters and all that. We are shielding ourselves from the hostile outside world, because that hostile outside world is very volatile and it's annoying. You know, it's creating a lot of churn, a lot of problems. And we're just kind of living for now in this ideal world that lives inside the main memory, where we are the masters of the universe. We decide everything, right? We can slice and dice however we want. We can design however we want. And we are not relying on computing infrastructure to help us implement our processing logic. In other words, we are focused on implementing business policy rules. Business policy rules. That's where the money lies. That's why we are getting paid big bucks, because we can automate processing business policy rules. How we do that, the bosses don't care. Right, they have their expectations how the system should function, and it's our job to make our job as easy as possible by minimizing accidental complexity, and we do that by minimizing the dependencies, outside dependencies.
Okay.
And that.
Yeah.
Yes.
So many things there that I want to expand on. Okay, so we're talking about basically loosely coupling the I/O from the business logic and stuff like that. You know, we can imagine the opposite scenario where there's a file, it's just procedural code where at the top we open the file, read it in, do some processing, and give our output. But in that scenario, it's quite possible that the file I/O will end up intertangled with the business logic code. And there's a few symptoms that come along with it. One is it's just harder to understand. If you're looking at a piece of unfamiliar code and trying to understand what's what, it's harder to understand if everything's mixed together than if the I/O happens somewhere else. And then another thing is that the implementation is very hard to change. Like, one thing that I like about the idea of writing tests and composing objects just for the business logic, ignorant of the I/O, is that the I/O could change. Maybe this command line program, we actually like it and we find it useful and we want to put a web UI on it. I really like the idea that all of our tests would still be valid even if we change the I/O to something else. And maybe this isn't the greatest example, because things like that tend not to change very drastically. But there's a million other cases of where you have two areas of concern and you want to change one, and you don't want to have to involve the other, either mechanically or cognitively, in order to make a change to the other one.
I would even argue, I'm totally with you on that one. I would even argue, and this is going to be very radical and whatnot, that it is our job, it is our promise to the business that whatever we build is going to be easily pluggable, child's play. Oh, all of a sudden you want to change this to be a voice input, a voice controlled. We should not be asking the business, oh, now I need to do a brain surgery on my system. I need like 3 to 4 months to revamp everything so that I enable this communication channel between the users and the system. Our job is to create a system that is completely immune to the perturbations that happen on the edges. And like you say, is it a web interface? Is it IoT, some edge computing? Is it voice? Is it text? You name it. Command line, doesn't matter. That's the point of hexagonal architecture, is that the system is functioning as expected. It's really testable. And then we can plug in and unplug. And it's called configurable dependencies. Alistair Coburn calls them configurable dependencies, where you can just easily, you know, tweak your system and plug and unplug and play with various devices, right, that are pluggable into your system. The system itself is blissfully unaware what has changed. It has no idea. All the dependencies are unidirectional. Some systems outside of the system are aware of the core system, but the core system knows nothing about outside world, doesn't care. It just does its job. It does it deterministically, predictably, and performant, securely, in a performant fashion. If we do that, we win. We are the heroes who have delivered on the promise. And I'm not later on going to call you and say, hey, we need to rework this. Like, come, you know, I told you yesterday, people get really upset when they pay for good money for something and it works, and all of a sudden it stops working, and now we have to rework. And they were like, why? They don't get it, right? And I think I'm with them. I agree with them. Why should you be paying again for something you already paid for? So our job is, I think, to design a system so that it can roll with the punches, and that's the value we bring to the table.
So I want to make a comment on the idea of predicting change. And I'm sure that you'll have a lot of thoughts on this, and I'm curious to hear your thoughts. You know, we obviously we can very safely predict that almost any software system we build is gonna change at some point. It's a little bit less predictable which parts are gonna change, although there are parts that are more and less predictable. You know, for example, we might choose PostgreSQL at the beginning. We can predict that it's unlikely that we're going to want to change to MySQL 5 years down the road or something like that. But we can probably predict that any of the business logic in the application is subject to change. And that's a good bet. And I think about these things in terms of bets, because we pay a price to make code maybe this isn't always true, but at least sometimes it's true that we pay a price to make code easy to change. And you know, if we, okay, for example, this recipe scaler where it starts off as a terminal application, maybe at least superficially, it seems like we pay a higher price to make the IO and the business logic loosely coupled so that that part may change. So we're making a bet. And in my experience, it's a better bet to bet that any particular thing we touch may change rather than to bet that it won't change, because then when we need to change it, it'll be quite painful. I don't think I quite articulated that as well as I wanted to, but I think you probably know what I mean.
Yeah, I totally got you. I would say my approach is that change, digital rot never sleeps. If you've been long enough in this profession, you know that change is imminent. It's not if, but when and how intense the change is going to be. So our best bet is to just migrate as much of the business know-how, of the business logic and policy rules into this castle, into this safe, psychologically safe space that is not dependent on any computing infrastructure, on any things that, you know, the vendors may change, AWS, this and that, blah, blah, blah. And we will actually have a nice, easy to work with kingdom where, like you say, of course, business rules are volatile, this and that, regulation change, market pressures. We should be able to move in and make those, a little bit of surgery here, there, without risking compromising the functionality of the system. And the more we do that, the better engineered the system is overall. Another very important thing that I learned from Kent Beck, which to me was extremely counterintuitive the first time I heard, but then I thought about it. He says, if the order of operations in your system is important, your system is not designed well. The yes. order of operations should never matter. This is the key, I think. And so many people are like, well, but of course it has to matter. First, I have to deposit some debt, you know. No, that's a tightly coupled, badly designed system. And how do we get away from that? My answer is TDD. And people are going to accuse me, oh, you think TDD is a silver bullet, you're the consultant, you're just trying to rake up your consulting fees. But no, I'm speaking honestly, at least in my experience, because I'm not a good coder, I'm not a good designer, I'm just average, right? I arrived so many times in my career at the aha moment that I would never get if I wasn't doing TDD. I would never get to that moment. But TDD reveals, as you are working, as you're doing this incremental, little by little, you know, chipping away, it reveals the flaws in the system. It points out, okay, this part is not testable. And as soon as I see that something is not testable, I know we have a lousy design. And I know that we have to put our heads together and revamp that.
Okay.
So it's all about...
So, sorry to interrupt, but I want to make sure I don't forget something you said. So you shared that Kent Beck anecdote about if your system depends on the order of operations, then that's a poor design. And I'd never heard that, but it resonates so much with my experience. And it, to me, it kind of relates to the difference between imperative and declarative programming. And so much, the vast majority of the code that I see is imperative rather than declarative. But, you know, I think this is kind of a subjective preference. Personally, I find declarative code easier to understand than imperative, because with declarative, there's less state that you have to keep track of in your head as you're reading the code. But what if somebody heard that and they said, oh, if your code is order dependent, then your design sucks. I don't buy that. What would you say to try to convince that person? Because I'm not sure that I can articulate what that argument would be.
That's a really good question. I would say if you are in a position where you cannot envision your system not being dependent on the order of operations, that to me is really a surefire indication that your business logic is heavily dependent on some computing infrastructure, something that is I/O bound.
Sorry, I just had a realization. I think if it's highly order dependent, that means it's highly state dependent.
Yeah, of course. And same is with tests who must run in certain order. That's a lousy. You know, right there, tests should be able to run in parallel and not no test should ever depend on some other tests to run first before it can run, right? That's the dictum, the first dictum of TDD. Your tests should run in any order. You can jumble them, randomize them. They always produce the same outcome, given the same arrangement or preconditions, right?
Yeah.
They should not change. The outcome should not change because, oh, actually, this test ran first, and all of a sudden, this test is failing. But if we didn't run, then it would pass. That's a lousy design right there. And you're right. It's all about the state. But the state can be maintained in memory as well. And still, even if the system is dependent on state, the order operation should not matter.
Yeah, I think I would agree. And just to round out that thought, if your program is dependent on operation order, then that means it's highly state dependent. And that raises the question, why is that bad? And my answer to why that's bad is because a program that's highly state dependent is harder to understand than a program that has less state.
I will go one further. I would say the program that where the state is important, otherwise it doesn't function properly, is not testable. You cannot test it. It's impossible to test. There's no determinism there. There's no, you are just kind of shooting, flying by the seat of your pants. Maybe your QA department, your testers have tested it from one angle and it seems to work. But guess what? The users will find another angle and will find ways to discover bugs. And that's going to give the black eye to your crew. Do you want to be there? Why don't you roll up your sleeves and really make the entire system fully testable so that, as Kent Beck says, I treat my test as an oracle. I come to my oracle and I ask it, hey, oracle, if I now put this in front of a live audience, will it blow or will it work as expected? And if the oracle says, no, everything's passing, it looks okay. And if I put it in front of people and it blows, then I stop trusting Oracle. I don't have confidence in my Oracle. Next thing you know, I stop writing tests. Next thing you know, we are back to the spaghetti, big ball of mud. So it only makes sense to write tests if you can 100%, you take it to the bank and you can sleep like a baby at night, knowing full well nothing's going to blow. Otherwise, if it's half-baked, it really doesn't serve anybody. It's actually wasteful. It's worse than not having any tests. That's my opinion.
Yeah, I see this a lot where organizations have some amount of tests, but the tests don't really, you know, some of the tests are valuable, but a lot of them are dubious. And a very common problem is that the tests are almost impossible to understand. And so, you know, talk about the Oracle. I guess there's a couple ways of looking at that. You know, there's you run the tests and you look at the result, passes or fails. That's very easy to interpret. But then in terms of the specification for your system's behavior, you know, your application's code is the source of truth for what your application does, but your tests are the source of truth for what it should do. And that's a greater source of truth. Because your application code happens to do a particular thing doesn't mean that that matches what it actually should be doing. But the tests are arbitrarily specified, and whatever they are is correct just by virtue of the fact that you decided the specifications and you encoded those specifications into tests. But if those specifications you decided on are totally inscrutable, then your tests have much less value.
Absolutely. What I'm actually mostly concerned about are false positives, where you have your fancy test and you're so proud of it, And you run them all before you actually ship your system, and they're all like green. And then you ship it and it blows, right? That's what I'm pointing at. This should never happen. So better not have any tests than false positives to lull you into this kind of safe, false sense of security. And I agree with you. I don't know if you heard Uncle Bob once commented that if somebody gave him a system that's very valuable and told him, you can either keep your shipping code or your tests, he said, I would keep tests. I would just chuck shipping code. And if it's really a good system, I know I can always, using the system, the test, I can always recreate the system. But from the system, recreating tests is like reverse engineering.
Yeah. That's
just not going to happen, right?
Yeah, it's really interesting. It would be so much cheaper to reproduce the application code than to reproduce the tests from the application code. Yeah.
Exactly. So again, you know, TDD is a very powerful design technique. People are up in the arms when I say that and blah, blah, blah. And why is it then called test-driven? But those tests are guiding my design thinking. Of course, I'm not saying that there are no genius out there, geniuses who can do it all in their head, but I have yet to meet such person. And even James Groening, and I'm pretty sure Ken Beck and all these like people who we look up to, James Groening told me, like, look, Alex, I used to think I was a good programmer. Then as I got older, I realized I really is not that good, right? So I need to do small baby steps, step by step. Each step, I check if something broke, right? And Ron Jeffries, I don't know if you know about Ron Jeffries. You know Ron Jeffries?
Yeah, I know of him. I think I have a book of his on my bookshelf.
Well, yeah, Ron is amazing. He's one of the agile co-signatories. He's famous, my mantra. Like if you ask me, Alex, what's your kind of, what's the word, like thing you put on in your office on the wall? He says, the trick is never to let the code not be working. This is the secret sauce of our profession. The code must always be working. We should never be in a position where I'm sitting here and I'm banging and I'm minutes go by and I'm 15 minutes neck deep into changes and 30 minutes and I'm cocky and I'm brash. That is very bad in my experience.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm glad you said that because that's one of my top principles that I teach new programmers. Because it's like, I compare it to like walking on a trail in the woods. Like it's much cheaper to keep looking down every few seconds at the trail and make sure you're still on the trail than to just look forward and then at some point you realize you've lost the trail and now you have to try to find the trail again. Good luck. You're probably not going to find it.
Yeah, exactly. That's it. Now, along those lines, have you ever worked, have you ever tried TCR?
No.
TCR. So I'm big on TCR. So this is, again, one thing that Ken Beck introduced. Ken Beck is just like a, I don't know what the word is, but so basically he says, I mean, okay, you talk to Ron Jeffrey and he will tell you, okay, I'm here looking at the system. Everything passes. The system is in full working condition. I now break the system. Why? How do I break it? I create that failing test. I create an expectation that's going to fail. It's broken, but I broke it. I know why I broke it. And I'm going to make it heal again, make it functional again by writing up a code that's going to make the test pass. Then I go in and refactor. Now, during refactoring, it may so happen that I'm making some stupid decisions and the test that used to pass now fails, right? We've all been there, right? You have a passing test, you go in and say, okay, now I'm going to do a little bit of refactoring to make the code more easier to change, right? And in the process, you broke the system. And what usually then people do, they try and kind of modify the code, make it pass. He says, no, I go git reset hard. And just like, why? Because he's making baby steps. So TCR stands for test and commit or revert. So you make a little code change, just really innocuous little code change. You run the entire system. If everything passes, it commits. If it fails, git reset hard. So you reset back to the most recent healthy state of your system. This is TCR. I love that. I like to do that.
Yeah, this is so interesting because some of these things you've saying, I've like independently arrived at these conclusions myself, but maybe not by the same names. I had heard of TCR, but I didn't know what it was until right now. But I practice the same thing. Like when I'm working with people and everything's working, and then suddenly things aren't working, their first instinct is, oh, okay, let's figure out what's wrong. And I say, no, don't even try to figure out what's wrong. Just blow it away and start over. And the thing I would add is, like, at least with my own work, it's like, if I try something and it doesn't work, I'll blow it away and I'll start over, but more carefully. Because the fact that it didn't work tells me I was maybe being too cocky and trying too big of a change at once.
Oh, yeah. And TCR works, the way I work with TCR is baked into the editor. So anytime I make a change, it automatically does this whole shebang, right? That teaches me to be super, super humble. Almost humility, right? So now I'm not rushing, because, you know, if you spend some time crafting some code and now it's just your snowflakes, it's your pet, you give it the name, you're so proud of you, and it blows, it disappears. You're like, you're hurt. But if a tiny little change disappears, okay, you're not that emotionally attached to it. So it teaches us not to get emotionally attached to our crafted code. And it's along those lines that I think right now expression is frowned upon, but it used to be cattle, not pets. I don't know if you've heard of that.
What is it?
Cattle, like cows, you know, cattle.
Oh, yeah, cattle or pets,
Not pets. So our systems, we should treat them as just cattle, just huge ranch cattle, not like our beloved dog and our beloved cat, and give it a name and you love it, and, oh, I don't want anything to happen to my pet. So that, in other words, you should be in a position to mass slaughter this entire cattle and just breed another one, without having any emotional, I mean, it's an ugly, I hate that because I love animals, but it's a very strong illustration as to how we get attached to our work.
Right.
And teaches us to work in small steps rather than big batches and big chunk heroic, which, again, I was like that. I was a heroic programmer and I would like spend whole day just writing code, never even tried to compile, you know, it's all, and it was back then, it was a rite of passage. It was like how they were evaluate you. Are you this tall to write? Can you join our tribe? Alex, let me see you write this entire program and then see if you'll compile, right? It's a completely different mindset. And today we are the exact opposite. Every tiny little change I make, I want to make sure everything works as expected.
Yeah, that's another mistake I often see with beginners. They put a lot of time and effort into trying to get things right on the first try. But it's actually vastly more expensive to try to get things right on the first try than to not worry about getting things right on the first try and letting the iterative process guide you to something that's ultimately correct.
Yeah. I remember my first job. I was young and kind of brash. And I had a manager, and she was sitting in her office, and I was like right across there. And one day she came to me, you know, Alex, I'm watching you work and I'm amazed. You bang the code all day long. And like, you know, not like other, I'm watching other people every now and then they make a change. They have to see if it's going to compile, if it's going to run. And then I got promoted. So I got rewarded from being arrogant and a prick, right? It was a different, it was a wrong-headed mentality about software. We valued and we rewarded those like people who, no, I'm going to do everything perfect in the first try because I'm the, you know, the macho dude who's cranking code. Ever since then, I completely 180, I'm now humble and I'm all like pussycat and I walk in the actions like, I don't know, you know, I'm pretty, apprehensive of changes.
Yeah, I have a mantra that I repeat to myself, which is never underestimate your ability to screw stuff up.
Oh, yeah, of course. We are brilliant at that. Yeah, we are all geniuses at that.
Yeah, and I'll add something, like you were talking before about, I don't remember, but all these things we were talking about, it's like, we don't do these things because we're smart. We do these things because we're stupid. Like, yeah. If we had infinite cognitive ability, we could just write an entire program and save it directly to production, and that would be no problem. It's only because our cognitive abilities are limited that we have to have tests and small commits and write code that's understandable and stuff like that.
Oh, yeah. And also, you know, I realized after so many years, and I just stumbled upon that, but it really resonates. There is something called in the U.S. Navy, when they are bringing in, you know, those huge airplane carrier ships, just enormous. when you want to moor them, when you want to bring them into moorage, it is not a trivial matter. And turns out that you cannot have a control, centralized control tower, which will guide the ship. It's just not feasible. So how they do it? It's very interesting. They have the crew spread out throughout the moorage. And somehow, I don't know how, they work it out, and they figure out how to bring the ship in without any damages. This is called, in the literature, distributed cognition. And I think software is distributed cognition. It's exactly how we do things. We need to have a crew of people, and we need to work in real time, and we need to bring this baby in. And working in isolation, like you say, heroically, you know, muscle bound, is just going to result in breakages. And so my epiphany is that we need to work. And by team, I don't only mean developers. It should be all the other, anybody with a skin in the game, anybody who has vested interest in the software product should be there doing distributed cognition, should be there when we need them the most to answer all these questions, you know, to kind of, hey, we were thinking about this. What do you think? You know, rather than in a asynchronous manner, handing you over the document and you're reading through, you know, it is a very low bandwidth communication.
Yeah. Yeah. I think people are quite often penny wise and pound foolish when it comes to efficiency. You know, we want to be efficient and have a 100% utilization rate and don't waste people's time by getting on calls and stuff like that. When, again, that's penny wise and pound foolish, because that might save you time in a day. But if you play that out over a month, I think it's much more efficient to do the seemingly less efficient methods of working.
Yeah, exactly. And you know what they say, the fully utilized highway is a parking lot. So you can shoot yourself in the foot quite easily by zeroing in on utilizing all your available resources.
Sorry, I just have to interrupt and say that is such a great quote.
Because that's what it is, right? And so when they call me in to transform the organization, the team, I'm always like, first thing first, let's agree, or you want to discuss, but I would say, let's shift our focus from optimizing for utilization, which is an intuitive thing to do because we're paying big bucks. You can calculate how much per hour and you add it up, it's like a lot of money. And naturally you want to optimize for utilization because I'm paying so much money. But instead, can we try and shift our focus to optimize for value delivery and not worry about how we get there, just what do we need to do? And it's similar to the relay race where they pass the baton. Like if I have a team and I'm the manager and we're in a relay race and we are rushing to pass that baton over the finish line, I'm not going to be keeping an eye on runners. I'm going to be keeping an eye on the baton. That's the only thing that matters to me. I don't care about, let you guys figure out who's going to pass the baton, how. If I see the baton not moving, I intervene, you know. And so too many managers keep an eye on the runners. Oh, why is this guy not running? And what about the baton? It's stuck there. It's not moving. But I want to see, I'm paying this guy. I want to see him running. That to me, a pound foolish again. So we need to prioritize and establish the perspective. What do you want to do? Do you want to deliver value? You want to be competing on the market? You want to put something that the customers are going to value and pay for? They don't care how much you utilize somebody in the back office, right? They're not going to pay for that. You know, they're going to come to them and say, look at all these like Jira tickets and all our user stories. They're not paying for that. They're also not going to, you cannot sell them tests. They're not paying for tests either, right? They're just paying for the functionality. And so the mantra is code is a liability, functionality is an asset. We treat code as an asset, but code is inventory. It's, you know, if I can deliver something without writing a line of code, I would go for it 100% right. Because of functionality. And code is always a headache. It's inventory, it's something to worry about, you know, babysit it, etc. But that's not how a lot of developers, they think they're superstars and they're valued by this bloated code that they write. No, it's a problem. It's not a solution, right? And being busy is not a solution, right? You can be busy until the cows come home. It doesn't matter. But that's another thing that when I'm managing teams, when I tell them, guys, I don't care how busy you are. They're very kind of like, oh, what kind of manager is this? You know. But in reality, we want to see value being delivered. That's why we are paid what we're paid for. nobody's paying you for being busy.
Yeah. Something I think about sometimes is like, if you run a test suite and the test suite takes 10 minutes to run, first of all, maybe there's an argument to be made that it should be optimized, whatever, but I don't want to focus on that part. The test suite takes 10 minutes to run. And so now you have a 10-minute period where you can't move forward on your current task because you're dependent on this feedback. So what should you do during that 10-minute period? I think conventional wisdom would dictate that you should switch to a different task and move forward on a different task during that 10 minutes. But I'd argue that it's better just to sit there, go for a walk, or read a book, or watch a YouTube video or something like that.
First of all, I forgot to mention the real focus of TDD is speed of test suite. How it must be as fast, screamingly fast as possible. And Ken Beck had a nice write-up where he explains there are certain thresholds. If it takes longer than 2 seconds, 5, 10, you go to 30 seconds, minute, 2 minutes, it's disaster. And that is the reason why we are professing and advocating to avoid I/O in TDD, because we want those tests to be screaming fast. Even thousands of tests should run in like sub-second, a couple of seconds. The test should never be your bottleneck. If the tests are your bottleneck, we have a bigger problem here. First of all, the system is not designed properly, right? Because there's a lot of I/O. And secondly, your flow is interrupted. It's waste. So really, the prime directive, I would say, in TDD is avoid I/O. If your test is slowing down, revamp the whole system. Think seriously about migrate. You obviously have your logics, your business logics stored somewhere else. Maybe it's in a stored procedure somewhere in some database, blah, blah, blah. Migrate back into the core. Focus on your core competence. The competence layer is what you are building and selling, right? This is where the big bucks lie. This is where the business would not hire you if they could buy that off the shelf. They couldn't buy off the shelf. Therefore, you are here to promise that's going to be in. And once it's in, then it's going to be easier to make sure that the tests are not your bottleneck. They should never be your bottleneck. And also, furthermore, they're really helping you further design the system and making sure that any changes are always testable. That's the prime directive. Anything you do, it must be testable. If it's not testable, there are many reasons why not. Maybe you have a hidden input, right? Hidden inputs are lousy, right? So right there, you have a design paradigm, which is like never use hidden input in your code. Always explicitly pass the value, right? Stuff like that. There's millions of these things. TDD is teaching you that, right? Because I remember once I wasn't aware of that and I had hidden input. And I could not test the bloody thing because it's always different when the tests run. Right? And I realized, okay, this is a lousy design. I'm really bad at designing software, right?
I want to bring us back to something we were talking about a long time ago, which is the order dependency and the imperative versus declarative coding. Mm-hmm. There is a mental disease which is going through the Ruby community. It has been for a few years of what people refer to as service objects. And it's a very ill-defined term because it means different things to different people. Most of the time when people talk about what they call service objects, they're really talking about the command pattern, where it's an object that carries out a single action and it's named as a verb like update user or something like that. And it has a single method called call, and you do update user.call. And it's all about, you know, and if you look inside one of these service objects, it's procedural code. This happens, then this happens, then this happens. And I wanted to touch on that because this is something that I try to disabuse people of whenever I can, but it's a bit hard. And often when I say something negative about service objects, people say, well, okay, Jason, what should we do instead? And that's hard to articulate also because it's not simple. But this thing you said about if your code is order dependent, then it's a lousy design, that makes me think of, it gives us some ammunition to use against this flawed idea of service objects in a concrete way that people can understand. Maybe we could explore that a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people find this counterintuitive and also difficult to explain from my side. But the secret to simplicity, and we are talking here about fighting accidental complexity by zeroing on simplicity. The secret to simplicity is what we call more of the same. And that does not resonate with that. That's very hard to explain. But really, that the secret ingredient, if you are faced with accidental complexity or this command object that is untestable because blah, 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 then my first knee-jerk or whatever, my ingrained reaction will be more of the same. Let's break it down into smaller, easily testable chunks, right? And then once we design it that way, make sure that the order of these operations don't matter. That no matter at one point you call that module, whatever it is, it will give you the predictable result.
And I think that's the key. Like, yeah. I think if you were to take all the service objects in the world and, or let's say you're faced with a particular service object, if you were to take that object and break it down into a constellation of objects where it was true for all of them that the order of operations doesn't matter, then you'd have something that more resembles the style in which I'd do it. Which I don't know exactly what you call that style, because to me, you just call that object-oriented programming. It doesn't exactly have a name.
But again, the trick is simplicity doesn't mean lessening the number of things. It's increasing. It's producing more of the same. And that's how you achieve simplicity. This is counterintuitive because people always think, well, simplicity means you just get rid of everything. You're just down to one. This is one God class. This is not simplicity. God class is like mind-numbing complexity.
Right.
So more of the same is the trick to get there. And people are not being taught that.
Yeah, and the simplest rule in the world is, how do we organize our code? We use service objects for everything. That's a very simple rule, but it yields great complexity. Because, you know, the complexity lies in reality. Reality is complex. And our job as programmers is to manage the complexity of reality. And the only way to yield something simple is to meet that complexity with complexity. If you put the complexity through simplicity, out the other end will come complexity. If you put that complexity through complexity that meets it, then that'll neutralize the complexity and you'll end up with something more simple.
Yeah, I mean, what you're talked about is what I would call essential complexity, meaning you cannot whittle it down. It is what it is. You're faced with a complex situation where it's very intricate, and that it is what it is. There is no way to simplify it, because you'll be breaking the law if you simplify it, right? And then we move in to automate that or to kind of build a system on top of that. We need to be really careful as we're doing that not to introduce accidental complexity, because we'll be shooting ourselves in the foot. And what is accidental complexity? It's complexity that is not needed, not necessary. If you remove it, things still work. So that is a secret sauce in software development, is being always on the lookout and fighting against creeping accidental complexity. And in my experience, the best way to accomplish that is by doing a permaculture by succession, meaning incremental TDD from baby steps, from little brain dead system that barely function, and going step by step and growing the system. That way, there's no room with those tiny little steps. There's no room for accidental complexity to slide in.
Yeah, you're only adding what's absolutely necessary and no more.
And it's fully testable and it's predictable. And therefore, accidental complexity is not going to trick you. But if we are more lenient, then you don't even realize when on the back door, all of a sudden you're looking at the big monster, you don't even realize it's there. And by the time you realize it's kind of too late, and now you're asking the business people to, hey, give us 3 months, we need to, or do you give us 6 months, we need to rewrite that. And they're like, come on, I thought you guys are pros. Like, what, why are we paying you? So we need to be really careful to establish confidence. I mean, people sometimes say you need to build trust. No, they trust us. They interviewed us, they know we're smart, they trust us. but they don't have confidence in us. Why? Because we keep breaking things, right? And they know we're not doing it because we are mean-spirited. We're doing it because of a certain level of incompetence or whatever. I don't want to name names, but we need to establish confidence. They like us. They hired us. It's like my children. I trust my children, but do I have confidence in them? You know, I'm always like trying to make sure that, hey, you need to prove to me that I can have confidence in you, that you can travel and go to, you know, Portland or somewhere, you know. And same is with us, right? These people are investing a lot of money in us, right? And they are expecting us to convince them that these guys know exactly what they're doing. I don't have to worry about it. So far, in many situations, I've seen that this confidence is not there, rightly so. I cannot blame them because we keep breaking things. And they keep wondering, like, okay, so it first looked like these guys know what they're doing. We pay them, everything works fine. All of a sudden, it starts breaking. This is not, you know, it's like when you build a house and it starts crumbling and all. Well, at first the house looked really nice, but now I see it's a house of cards. Ooh, did I throw, and I'm throwing good money after bad money. They don't like that. And I don't blame them. I will be in the same
predicament. I want to touch on something else. And I know we have to start wrapping up soon, but we were talking about essential complexity and accidental complexity and how TDD can help with that and stuff like that. I want to bring up an extremely common mistake that I see with not just beginner programmers, but very experienced programmers also, which is what I call coding speculatively, which is adding behavior beyond what you're sure is needed. And that so many evils come from that. And it's very tempting. And I certainly used to do it myself. And sometimes I catch myself still doing it. But you know, what that is when like you have an idea for a need, but you're not sure that it's really needed, but you build it anyway and you don't test it. And so now you have this superfluous piece of code, and it's all liability and not necessarily any asset because it hasn't been proven that it's needed.
And to make things even worse, now it's your pet.
Yeah.
And you will get upset if they chuck it, and like, why did you chuck my pet? I worked so hard and I think it's a great piece of code, etc. This is called the agony, as far as I remember. I don't know if you heard of the acronym YAGNI.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
You aren't going to need it. And this is the extreme programming mantra. But in a broader sense, yesterday we talked about this, and I couldn't remember the name, then I remembered. There is something called validated learning, where, okay, we may be speculating, you know, we don't know everything. And then when we put our speculation, this is called hypothesis-driven development. You have a hypothesis. For example, a simple hypothesis would be, hey, I think if we were to rearrange this or whatever, we add this box here, I think our subscription volume will increase. That's a hypothesis. You know, maybe some cocky people say, I guarantee you I can put this $100 in this book. But anyway, we don't know until we get there. So now we make that change, we ship it, and now what is important to get is the validated learning, meaning there should be a telemetry that's going to give us a feedback. It's going to say, did this change really increase our subscription rate, or did it maybe it's less now, or maybe it stays the same, right? So that is the feedback. We talked about this yesterday, that a lot of development teams are not getting. And in an example I gave you, even if they put those observability telemetry in production, they're not allowed to even access the logs in production, right? So they work in the dark. It's like assembling IKEA furniture in a dark room. You can feel your way through. You can kind of, oh, I see this is the hole here. I put the bolt here. When you flip the switch on, it's like, oh, this is all crooked. And right? So we need to change that. We need to create a situation where you and I, as we are making changes to the system, and we should be very clear on the feedback that this change made in the hands of users. Did it improve things, worsen things? Did it make any difference? We must know that. And also working with business stakeholders, we need to talk about these hypotheses. We can bring our own hypothesis, they can bring their own hypothesis, and then we slice them. We make them as small as possible so that we can quickly put it out, put the feelers out, and say, hey, wow, your hypothesis is awesome. Look at this. It shoots through the roof, right? But unless, my opinion, unless you put it in real world, you'll never know. You can be, nobody has the crystal ball. Nobody can guarantee you what's going to happen once you put something out, right? And so for some reason, there's this kind of chasm between us who are making changes and customers who are actually using it. And that is too bad. That is very sad, because we should be, you know, in the DevOps community, there is a mantra: you build it, you run it. If I build something, I want to run it. I want to see what it's doing. And that is a big oversight. To split between people who are building something and people who are running something. It's not a good idea. And that's why DevOps, right? But DevOps, again, mushroomed into cloud ops.
And we have this term DevOps team, which is funny because it's a total oxymoron.
Oxymoron. They're running it. We developers have no idea what's going on there, right? We schedule weekly meetings, and it's all like, okay. So it's a make-believe world, but what we really need is a pulse on the real system. And I'm the first guy, when I build something, I'm super invested. I'm super curious to see what is it actually doing. I'm very keen on that, but nobody's allowed me to do that, right? So that political, that needs to change, I think. If we are indeed serious about quality software, quality engineering, and of course, growing the business that makes sense, right? But culturally, I think we're not there
for some reason. Yeah, and that's a whole another can of worms that I have tons of thoughts on, and I'm sure you have tons more thoughts yourself, but we'll have to save that one for another conversation. Well, Alex, this has been really great. I feel like it's been really densely educational, and there's a lot of nuggets there for people to take away. Where should people go if they want to find out more about you and that kind of stuff?
I'm mostly very active on Twitter, even though I don't like Twitter, but there's a lot of people who I admire on Twitter and kind of interacting with them. I recently started following you. Of course, LinkedIn, I'm not too happy about it, but recently I discovered Substack. And I'm starting to warm up to Substack. I don't know if you ever looked into Substack.
Not really.
The reason I like it is for two reasons. One is you seriously, honestly, you own your material. Whatever you put there, it's yours, meaning you can, and I can go there and I can just grab it and close the account and that's it. It's mine. They claim no ownership of my material. Secondly, I own the platform as well. The platform is mine. It's not theirs. So that's really revolutionary, because all the Facebooks and Twitters, they basically use us as slaves who are rowing the, you know, and they're sucking our blood and our emotions. And then they have these nefarious algorithms to kind of try and hypnotize you into some bullshit. No such thing on Substack. There's no ads. There's no like algorithms that nasty. There's no slimy porn bots or any of that. So how do they work? They actually, you can offer paid subscription to your content. They actually take just percentage of that. And they don't need any other source of revenue. That's good enough for them to run their business. So I would recommend maybe try that. So I also have three YouTube channels. One is I'm inviting guests such as yourself. I'll probably invite you in my channel. It's called Software Breakthroughs for the 21st Century, where we talk about what are the new things that did not exist in the 20th century and made their way into the 21st century. People like Woody Zuhl and, you know, all these people who introduced mob programming and no estimates and all these interesting things. I like to talk with these people about, learn from them about it. It's very educational. Another channel is Coding Interviews with Alex. So we have a phony fake coding interviews where I call some really, you know, high octane coders. And let's pretend you're applying for a job and I'm now interviewing you. So you are here live coding. I give you a challenge and you're live coding and explaining to us why you're doing this. And it's really great to see how they're doing TDD, their way of thinking. It's really hands-on, in-depth going through. I mean, you can learn a lot from these guys, much more than you can learn from me, because they're way more advanced, right? And my third channel, I call it Diary of a Perplexed Software Developer, where there are things that perplex me, and I vent, just me and the phone. I'm like, okay, guys, I don't understand why. Can I not get access to the logs in production so that I can understand what is my system doing, right? Why that red tape? You know, people say, yeah, but there's some sensitive information. You can mask it. There's tools to mask, you know, all the sensitive info. I'm not going after credit card numbers or something. I'm just going after logs to tell me how the system behaves, who does what, who bails out, who, you know, commits, etc. Those types of things. So these three channels, I think, could be interesting to some people, right?
Okay.
But I'm now more gearing on the Substack, trying to write a book on TDD, which can touch and go, right? And then I have published a number of articles in the open source community. This is my, I don't know if you can see.
Okay, opensource.com.
Yeah, so I published a lot of, they're a pretty good community. I published a lot of articles, mostly on TDD, mutation testing, zombies, you know, things we talked about today, and in general, DevOps. And right now, I was hired by another publishing house in the UK to write series of, this is now paid gig, to write series of in-depth TDD articles. I can send you a link later. I don't have it off the top of my head. So I'm getting more and more into, you know, trying to get involved in helping people make that transition, make that flip over and make the transformation, and to say, okay, let's stop chasing after people and cornering them and making sure that everybody's plate is full just because we're paying them money, right? Let's instead look into how can we optimize this team so they can deliver, and they will I'll let them sort it out among themselves how they're going to work. I'm not going to breathe down everybody's neck, right? I'm just going to say, guys, we want to do this. You go and figure it out, right? It's kind of similar if you go to a symphony orchestra or a jazz combo concert, and now you paid your ticket and you're sitting and watching the performance, and you say, hey, this guy's not playing. Like, why did I, you know, saxophone player stopped after he throws, like, hey, why am I paying this ticket? The guy's not playing. I insist everybody has to play at all times, right? So that's sometimes how I see teams in software development. Everybody has to be busy all the time. Why?
That's an interesting metaphor, and when you put it like that way, it makes a lot of sense. Since you brought up Substack, I'll share. I'm doing something even more radical, which is I have a, you know, okay. So people build audiences on platforms, and then the platforms might capriciously kick the person off their platform, and then their whole livelihood goes away overnight. Or, you know, TikTok might get banned, and people are unhappy about that because they've built a livelihood there. It's like, well, boo-hoo, you built your house on somebody else's land. But I'm doing something even more different, which is I have a snail mail programming newsletter. Uh-huh. Yeah. Nice. So it comes to your actual mailbox, and you can sit on your couch and read it on a piece of paper instead of staring at your screen for another half an hour or whatever. And like it's called Nonsense Monthly. If you just Google Nonsense Monthly, it'll come right up. And I ship all over the world. At one point, it started off free, and I had people in like 80 different countries receiving the letter. But I had to start charging because it was just too much postage. Yeah. Anyway, Alex, we'll put all those things you mentioned in the show notes, your YouTube channels and such. Thank you. And it was really great talking with you. And thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you. I really enjoyed this. It's such a pleasure to talk to somebody that we can bore into like those like tough, difficult areas and not be like, okay, what the hell are you talking about? You know, you can, and I like that. And again, you know, you and I both admire Kent Beck. And to me, Kent Beck is the epitome of how we should be thinking in software. Just always keep moving, always keep poking around at the edges, you know, turning things upside down. I like, for example, just one last talk, if you don't mind, Ken Beck's approach is like, okay, so I come across a lot of good ideas. Okay, and basically I know if it's a good idea, chances are somebody's already kind of tried it and figured it out. But if I come across an idea that doesn't make any sense, this kind of looks stupid, then I have to try it. Because I know nobody's tried it.
That's funny.
I have to try it. And that's how he discovered TCR and things like that. Because at first, like, everybody would say, well, why would I, you know, git reset hard, like I lose all my work. That's crazy. But, you know, it took on. So that's how I am. I like to poke around the edges. Like, oh, wow. This looks... One of my recent pet peeves is like, I really see no reason why do we have to make changes in an environment that is different from the environment where the change is going to be used. It makes less and less sense to me. Why are we shipping? In my old days, my early job, I was developing software for hospitals in British Columbia. So I had to actually save it on the magnetic tape. I drive to the hospital and I install it, right? This was shipping.
Wow.
Today, unlike your snail mail, we don't have to ship anything. So I'm thinking we should engineer the system where we make changes right there in production. But why go through the charade of okay, development and then, you know, QA and then, you know, staging and UAT and blah, 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 until it's just wasteful. And it has so many delays and those loops and blah, blah, blah. That's just nonsense. So I think we should look into switching to making changes in real system and see exactly what's going on, right? Then people say, well, how do you do it? Well, we're the engineers, figure it out.
Yeah, that's interesting. That's a very radical idea, but I like radical ideas.
Basically, why wait on somebody else to solve your problem? You're the engineer. You consider yourself pretty good or smart or whatever. Who's stopping you from figuring it out, right? That's my point. And I know it can be done. It's just that people never think about it. And with right endorsement and sponsorship, it can be done. As a matter of fact, I know people who are doing it, so I know it's not impossible.
I had a job many years ago where we did exactly that, but not in a safe, healthy way, in a very reckless, stupid way, to be frank. But yeah, I can, you know, something like TCR in production, if the test passes, then it appears in production immediately.
Yeah. And our job is to make it safe and worry-free and expedite and really high octane development right there in production. There's no reason why we shouldn't be able to do it. It's just that there is no will to do it. Because whenever I message anybody, they're like, oh, this is crazy. What are you smoking?
Right.
People are so accustomed and ingrained in this like endless, so many environments, this and that, and GitHub flow, you know, come on.
Yeah. Well, not to be grim, but there's a saying that science advances funeral by funeral. Maybe it'll be the same way with software development, where we just have to wait for the old ways to literally die, and then we can replace those with new ways.
Yeah. And that's my focus in the software breakthroughs for 21st century. Can we talk about these breakthroughs and what is possible? What can we do? We need a breakthrough. We cannot keep going the way we were doing 70 years ago or 60 years ago. And we keep rediscovering some of these old 60-year-old concepts.
It's so funny. It can be kind of depressing sometimes. We create the same problems and then come up with the same solutions as if they're revolutionary. Okay, we really do have to wrap up. But again, thanks so much for coming on the show. Really enjoyed it.
Yeah, thank you, Jason. We'll talk later.